Hey, gang. Gang. I don't know why I said that, but anyway, I'm going to run with it. Hey, gang. It's us. It's your boys. We are back, and you are listening to a little pod with big aspirations. We call ourselves Lifetime Cinema Club, and as always, I'm your host, Ryan, and I am once again joined by my co-host and research expert, Holsh. What's going on, buddy?
Hey, Chippy. Not a lot. Busy week, but got my notes together, watched the movie in question, and yeah, really looking forward to just chin wagging with this one.
Yeah, there's a bit to take in on this one, in more ways than one. yeah, there's going to be a few people out there that are going to probably be surprised at this pick, and it might shock some people when they first watch it, but I hope people do dive in. But before we get to what the film is, I'll just go ahead and let everybody know, if you are a first-time listener, you have stumbled across Lifetime Cinema Club, and this is a project that's been years in the making and covers a lifetime. So what we're doing is we're counting down the 10 best films from each year of my lifetime, beginning in 1980 and going all the way to current day. We've now got an Instagram, so find us at Lifetime Cinema Club. And we're on Reddit as well. We've just created a Reddit forum. So, you know, hit us up on there. Reddit's always got the goods, especially with memes. It's ground zero for some really great content there and Twitter. Twitter is launching soon. Speak of it. I refuse to call it X. Fuck Elon Musk. I'm not going there. I'm calling it Twitter for life. We'll soon be creating an email address, probably Lifetime Cinema Club, but that's not confirmed yet. Don't email those people in case it's somebody else. But we'll be launching an email address too soon. Well, you can send us an email. Tell us we're dumb and we're stupid and we have stupid taste and we're stupid idiots. Or say, hey, guys, thank you so much for highlighting a film that I'd never seen before. That would be really nice. But I know how the internet works, so it's going to go both ways, and that is cool. Last week, if you were listening, we featured our number 8 film for 1980, and it was the sexually charged relationship drama focusing on obsession and the male gaze. It was, of course, Nicholas Roeg's classic Bad Timing, a film that I said last week and I stand by, probably is underrated even by myself now at number 8 for 1980, but hey, we persevere, we keep going. So number 8 was Bad Timing. This week, for number 7 in 1980, we feature yet another controversial, challenging, and sexually charged thriller, more along the lines of an American version of the Giallo-style filmmaking. This is starring the GOAT, Al Pacino. And look, I know, Holsh, you picked up on this during the week that I already called Harvey Keitel the GOAT in the last episode. I've got a lot of goats, man. I'm a goat enthusiast.
I'm going to keep a running tally of how many goats we come across over this journey.
Well, absolutely, because there's going to be a lot more. And you could even add Teresa Russell, last week's star of Bad Timing as well. She had the GOAT performance. So I've got a few goats already. I'm collecting goats. Stars the GOAT, Al Pacino, and a plethora of legendary character actors in support or cameo roles in this film. People like Paul Sorvino, Karen Allen from the Indiana Jones films, Joe Spinell, Powers Booth in a really cool blink and you miss it cameo, Ed O'Neill from Married with Children, my boy Al Bundy, and Mike Starr as one of the sleazy cops at the beginning of this film. This week, we bring you that comes in at number 7 for 1980. It is, of course, William Friedkin's Cruising.
The Lifetime Cinema Club.
So if you have ever sat there and wondered, like I have many a time, what a leather daddy Al Pacino would look like, then look no further than this movie. As always, before deep diving into the film itself, I like to give a little brief rundown on the plot. And the plot of Cruising, courtesy of Letterboxd, is explained thusly: a serial killer brutally slays and dismembers several gay men in New York's S&M and leather districts. The young police officer, Steve Burns, played by Al Pacino, is sent undercover onto the streets as a decoy or bait for the murderer. Working almost completely isolated from his department, he has to learn and practice the complex rules, of which we will touch on during this episode, and signals of this little society. Now, director William Billy Friedkin, obviously, well, not so much, obviously, people might not know this, but he passed away late last year, a recent RIP to our boy Billy Friedkin. This guy was never afraid to ruffle feathers. He has brought out some really controversial pictures in his time. This was not the only film to attract controversy, obviously, because he was famously the director of The Exorcist itself, a highly in-your-face film considering the time in the early 1970s and still one of the absolute standards of the horror genre. He also has multiple other masterpieces on his resume, The French Connection, Sorcerer, To Live and Die in L.A. All three of those are just absolute masterpieces. The underrated and unfairly maligned films in his career came in the mid to early 90s, and they were Jade and Blue Chips. Jade kind of fell into the shadow of something like Basic Instinct, which it has a few parallels to, but another great erotic-style drama from the 90s. And Blue Chips, obviously starring Shaquille O'Neal and Anthony Hardaway, massive basketball freak, so that just tickles my fancy no end. William Friedkin also delivered some great examples of what we like to call in director circles, I guess, or auteur-loving circles, late style. He displayed his late style with films like Hunted, Bug, and Killer Joe, all of which have so much worth celebrating within those films. In my opinion, minor classics in their own right. Now, Holsch, I know that you have been recently on a mission to see as many blind spot classics that you haven't seen. And this week, you ticked off three really big ones. You saw Bullet for the first time with Steve McQueen.
Yep.
You saw Dirty Harry the other night for the first time.
Yep.
And you also saw The Exorcist, which we've just recently explained was one of the first big hits for William Friedkin. Now that you've seen two of Big Billy's biggest movies, are you vibing on Billy?
Mate, I loved both of them. And I think when you talk about The Exorcist and it being quite controversial at the time, once again, so beautifully shot. I guess my thinking of horror nowadays is very different, because I think back then the story in it is excellent. And the build is excellent, and it's not really all that terrifying again. Similar to Inferno, where it's just that real uneasiness the whole time, and I just thought, incredible flick. This one in particular, Cruising. Now, just to give you some perspective, this was probably, I think, the second or third movie out of your top 10 that I watched when you gave me the list. So yeah. I was still quite a naive boy. in the movie scene at this stage. And anyway, I just saw the front cover, blue cover, Al Pacino's melon on the front. I'm like, oh yeah, this will be, you know, a bit of a cop sort of movie. Yeah. I saw it was on YouTube. My wife was
you said, hey kids, sit down and watch this crime drama with daddy.
Well, Kate, my wife, was in with our six-year-old boy, because he gets a little bit afraid till he gets to sleep. So she was laying there with him till he fell asleep. And I rolled into bed and threw this movie on. And I'm about 5 minutes into it, and I'm sort of squirming a bit. I'm thinking, what is this movie about? To put it simply, it is a cop flick or a murder mystery flick, but it's the setting that for people that have never seen much of the S&M scene in New York, it was a real eye-opener for me for my first, you know, just laying there in my boxer pants in bed watching it. And yeah, and there's some.
Were they leather boxer pants by any chance, or were they just regular boxers?
They're leather now. I've bought a pair since watching this movie. But yeah, mate, I think both films beautifully shot. And like you said, Friedkin is he's a very fearless director. And the more that we talk about this tonight, you'll notice that, you know, he is just, nothing phases him. If he wants to get something done, he'll make it happen.
Oh, for sure. Friedkin be freaking. Like, he's just a freak. He wasn't afraid to go there. This film in particular obviously stirred up a lot of controversy and had issues behind the scenes. Ever since, really, there's still people out there in the gay community that find this offensive. And I can completely understand their stance on that as well, that it kind of shows the S&M community as psychos and like a really uncaring, almost like a death drive type of scene. So I can understand the apprehension that they had with this film at the time of release. And it's funny, it kind of offended everybody. So the people that the film was about, that community, they were offended about how they were being depicted. And then obviously in America, you've got these Bible bashers that get offended over everything, especially when it comes to anything gay rights or gay depiction. So you had those guys picketing as well. So it was, William Friedkin did not fail in his attempt to piss everybody off in 1980 when this came out. I know that you looked a lot into the history of this film, Holsh, again, because I'm the vibes guy. I watch stuff and get all lost in it, and you like to find meaning, and you love history, and you love finding out details, and you said there was quite a lot of issues during the production of this film.
Yeah, so as you touched on there, the LGBTQ community was in an uproar, but this was because one of the very popular voices on the, I don't know if it was in the radio or in a like a newspaper or something back in that time, like a village newspaper, I don't know, but he got hold of the script and then read through it, and obviously he would piece together what he was thinking. This is, you know, we're looking at murders. We're looking at this community. It's only going to be portrayed in a terrible fashion in his eyes. So he started voicing it, and then the community started getting behind. But it doesn't tell the whole story, because a lot of the community were all for it, because they also thought, well, you know, we'll get some exposure here and people can see what it's really like, because Friedkin is very much wants to use the real deal. So whether it's the real facts and the real people. In this film, in these bars, basically everyone is just the same people that frequent those bars as it is, apart from the main actors. But at the same time, while they're trying to screen this, the outside is doing everything they can to ensure it won't go ahead. So they've got whistles, they've got trash cans, they're smashing them, they're following Al Pacino around. Whenever he's spotted, they're like screaming at him, whether he's doing the cafe scenes or the any outside scene basically had to be redubbed, because
just to disrupt, they just wanted to disrupt everything.
Yeah, just absolutely. Yeah. But this is the reality of it. The gay community in the S&M scene isn't actually portrayed in a horrific manner here. If anything, the police force are portrayed much, much worse in this film. It's just that they've put it, connected it with the murder mystery aspect of it, and then believe that people will think that that's what happens in this type of community.
And I think the thought process and the, obviously the reaction to this film initially was so inflamed from all different facets, from the gay community, from religious groups. That has obviously tamed down somewhat. And I think people now, like you said, realize that this is as much an indictment on the processes and the prejudices that the New York City cops had at this time, as much as it is a focus on the S&M community. So I think that kind of narrative has come back around a little bit now, and it now favours the film, and you see a lot of people speaking out in favour of Cruising from the gay community, saying that the fact that they even have a depiction of like this kind of culture, as niche as it kind of is, that they were even had a presence in 1980, in hindsight, it was a good thing, right?
You have to also remember, mate, that AIDS didn't exist yet.
When 81, it really started to blow up, the AIDS epidemic, and you're right.
So it did exist, but it just, no one knew at that point. You know what I mean? It was probably there.
That's terrifying to think about too, because what you see in this film, throughout the film, is just blatant public sex, and not just public in the park, which you see a lot of in Central Park, but in various parks around Brooklyn, but within the club itself. And there's a few notorious things that we will touch on later, that it was just a free-for-all, very free-flowing sexual kind of energy going on at these clubs.
Yes.
to put it mildly. Yes, absolutely. Now, obviously, there was some, with that controversy upon release, there were a few actions that happened that were tragic. A few months after that film's release, one of the bars that were featured in the film came under attack and someone just opened fire, as unfortunately is the case in America. Probably wasn't as prevalent back then as it is now, or at least not as reported as much. This person killed a few people and wounded many others. I don't think Friedkin ever really went public about his thoughts on that, did he, Holsch?
From what I read about that, the killer never ever stated anything directly about cruising or in the lead up to it. So, you know, there was no reason for Friedkin really to comment on it anyway, but obviously everyone just were going to have a negative direction attack straight at that film because it was so recent.
Yeah, absolutely. They probably just connected the dots there and thought, controversial film featuring this bar. We have a mass shooter. Let's just connect the dots. And look, it could be fair to say if the killer never admitted any connection to it, well, then you are probably assuming, but could be a fair assumption to make, but a scary one at the same time. The basic premise is from a early 70s novel, and Friedkin uses that as the bones and structure of the film, but then also bases what happens as far as a few of the murders in the film over actual murders that happened in the late 70s. Now, if I'm correct, Holsch, did they find actual body parts in the river, or is that something that has been added in by Friedkin to begin the film?
Yeah, the body limbs being found in the water was a real event during the cruising murders in the late 70s that Friedkin discovered in his research. They don't really touch on it much for the rest of the movie, but I believe they use this in the very first scene in a powerful way to set up just how little effort the police actually put into solving these murders. It cuts to a scene where the policeman's discussing this rotting arm in the morgue with a forensic examiner, and it's really clear he wants absolutely nothing to do with the case, even though the examiner is really pushing that he simply can't ignore it.
See if you can match it to that torso that came in last month. Otherwise, you know, Doc, circumstances undetermined, pending a police investigation.
Wait a minute. We got a hand here. If we can get a fingerprint, we can make this a homicide.
All right. You give me a cause of death.
I can't give you the cause of death from this, but it's obvious it's not a suicide and it's not a natural.
Doc, you know I can't prosecute a homicide without a cause of death. That means I'd have to go out and find the rest of the body. No good, Doc. I got too much on my plate now.
Just a numbers game, huh? Body count? That's all it is to you guys. The only way you'll prosecute a murder these days is if you got a guy downtown signing a confession.
He has to follow this up. But the arm ends up being thrown in with some other body parts under what's known as CUPPY, which stands for Circumstances Unknown Pending Police Investigation, which was another very real fact that Friedkin discovered. There's a real theme from the get-go that the police are actually more aligned with the killer or killers in this movie than the S&M community.
It sets the tone really well for the film. So you know that we are dealing with instantly some grisly murders, obviously unsolved because they allude to it when they're in the autopsy room and the doctors are going through and taking fingerprints and things like that. There are other body parts that are being collected, and you see that at one point. The arm gets added to, I think, is it a torso and a leg?
Yeah. Yeah.
So you instantly know that we're in for some grisly stuff. And then straight from that scene, we basically shifted to a nighttime scene of two cops that are driving around, especially around the S&M community and the streets where those bars are located. And the cops are in this car and they are having this discussion and they are saying some of the most disgusting shit that you could ever hear. And it's probably some of the worst stuff that you hear throughout this entire film. And it's all misogyny. It's all one of these cops, his wife left him. They're all the fucking same. They're all bitches. They deserve what they're going to get. It is, and this is coming from cops.
She ain't gonna make a fool out of me. Takes the kids and goes to Florida to see his sister. Leaves me a note. 10 years.
They're all scumbags.
What?
They're all scumbags.
Who?
All of them. You're better off.
Just drive the car, huh? You'll be driving this car the rest of your life. What do you know? You don't know nothing. I'll get that bitch. She ain't gonna jerk me around. I'll get her.
You'll get her.
Damn straight I will.
And this is the first hint that the cops in this aren't the good guys. And in a lot of cases, they are never the good guys either, in general. This is made explicit from the get-go that these cops aren't going to help this community. They aren't going to try and solve these murders. And if anything, they could be contributing to the murders as well. And they transfer this hatred for women in this conversation, which again is just a terrible conversation having about one of their ex-wives and women in general. And then they just basically shift their focus to a couple of gay men walking the corners. They just start to use their power dynamics to basically confront these gay men, get them into the car, and basically abuse them mentally, physically, and eventually sexually.
You guys are hilarious.
Yeah? Come up here. I want to show you my nightstick. Move your ass. Get up here.
It's a really important scene, and probably out of a movie that has a lot of scenes that are uncomfortable to view, it's the one that strangely gives me the most ick. It is one that is really uncomfortable. And again, like I said, it shows the film's intent. And it's an unfortunate thing, I think, that a lot of people, especially in the gay community, initially thought that this was a film that was kind of attacking them or painting them in a not-so-great light. I think if you take this instant kind of introduction to the film as not an attack on the police, but a real critique of their policing styles. And look, there's so many stories and there's films and there's books written about how brutal the New York police were in the late 70s, early 80s, how kind of lawless it was as well, that they were just as bad as most of the criminals. That this really suits the tone of the film. I love this scene as much as I hate it.
I agree in that I think this scene is the hardest one to watch. There was another one on my first viewing, which we'll get to, which really...
I've got a fair guess what that is, but yeah.
But this on rewatches...
This is the one that makes me the most... uncomfortable.
Yeah, and you know what? Those two trans women are probably the two most likable characters in the film. Is that fair to say? I just feel like they actually talk civilly. There's no violence about them. They just seem very civil, even when they're talking to the police later in the police station.
They seem to have the most centered and most morally... don't want to say righteous, those two gay men or trans women, I apologize if I'm getting that wrong, they seem like they are the morally correct people in this entire, the most morally correct people in this entire film.
Yep.
They want what's going on to be solved. They need help. They are being abused, again, like mentally, physically, sexually, by these cops on a regular basis too. Like, it's made pretty clear the cops harass them all of the time. It's a regular thing. I even go to one of the chiefs of police, that Paul Sorvino character, and say to him, they plead with him, please, these guys are constantly hurting us, and we know they're down at the 6th precinct, and we know what they look like. We don't have their badge number, but we know who they are. They're constantly coming past it. We need help. And he still just ignores them and tells them to get out. From there, we have the police basically doing, as the film title suggests, that they are cruising. So cruising is the word used for gay men to find a sexual partner. In that, it's really fitting that you see that obviously the police cruising for, they use derogatory terms and slurs when they pick up these two trans women or gay men, but yet they then make them perform sexual acts on them in the police vehicle. We then turn to inside one of the S&M bars, and you said this to me straight away, Holsh. You couldn't believe how incredible the sound design was in this film, most notably the sound of the leather. And I found the leather and the clumping of the big, like, boots, the big bike boots. Yeah. That really just jumps out. I had a look into who responsible for the sound design, a guy called Charles L. Campbell. And interestingly, he has done a lot of work with some massive films, some of the biggest films of all time. He worked on Back to the Future, Schindler's List, E.T., Misery, heaps of stuff. So he's worked with some really heavy hitters. He's worked with Spielberg and Zemeckis and all types of people. Not only the sound design, but I really enjoyed the score, which was pretty subtle in parts and unobtrusive. It was scored by a guy called Jack Nitzky, and this dude has quite the resume. So he worked as well with William Friedkin on The Exorcist, but he also has worked with Paul Schrader on a few films, John Carpenter, Nicholas Roeg, who we spoke about last week. Wow. He worked on one of his films as well. So the sound design and the composition in this is really, really, really good. It just suits the film perfectly. And it makes little sounds like leather, like the clumping of boots, really jump out. It becomes just a really key part of the film. So does, obviously, and we'll get to this a bit later on when we talk about scenes in the park, but the colors that are used on the streetscapes and in the park, there's just these vibrant blues that are washed over the streets. And then when they're walking through the park, obviously the green of the vegetation, of the trees and everything really pops as well. My little theory on the really strong use of blue throughout the film is that it's basically a reference to blue movies, which is another name for porno. And look, we're in a underground sex kind of world in this film, so it kind of ties in that a lot of blue and blue movie for me. That's the connection I made from that, because I kept thinking to myself, it's so blue and I love it. It's artificial, kind of, but also has this natural kind of feel to it.
I love the shot where he's standing, leaning under that stone archway.
Yeah, that overpass there. It's incredible.
Mate, that, like, just take a photo of that. That's what you should be putting on socials.
So the scene that follows directly after the first murder that we see that you just mentioned, Holmes, had that incredible sound design. We're at the autopsy and the forensic pathologist is talking to Paul Sorvino, obviously the lead detective, I would call him, or the head cop.
The captain.
In the department. The captain, that's what I'm
captain
looking for.
Captain Edelman.
Talking to him, and he's standing there right next to this dead body that has got stab wounds throughout. And it isn't the sight of the dead body with stab wounds that makes him feel sick. It's the description that the forensic pathologist is telling him about the sexual acts that had occurred prior to the death that makes him gag, which suggests obviously that he's more disgusted in the act of homosexuality than he is in the act of murder. Did you pick up on that? Like, you saying about how that he found trauma around the rectum and he found traces of semen. And every time he said things like that, he basically is covering his mouth to stop himself from, like, vomiting. And yet he's just looking over this body like it doesn't matter to him.
Yeah, that's a very good call. I do remember it now vividly that you've brought it up. I didn't pick up on it quite so much. I guess Captain Edelman's probably seen a lot of murdered bodies. Maybe, like, the S&M scene, this might be the first time he's sort of moved into that region for a case. And, obviously he's definitely not comfortable with it.
No, he seems very shocked and appalled by that, and which is really quite funny because it leads into him calling in Al Pacino, or Steve Burns is his name, obviously is the character's name, calls in Steve Burns and says, "Steve, we've got a job for you, bro. We've got this thing going on in the underground S&M community the bodies are starting to pile up. We need someone to make a break in this case. You fit the description of the victims. We would like you to go undercover and basically don't tell anybody about this and just get heavily into this scene. And he basically, I think he says something along the lines. He goes, let me ask you this, Steve.
Let me ask you something. Have you ever had your cock sucked by a man?
A man? No.
Ever been porked? Or had a man smoke your pole?
You gotta be kidding. Yeah, you're kidding. I know it.
No.
No? Well, you got the wrong guy, I guess. That's all.
One thing I've noticed too, Holsch, is I don't know if it's by design or just by default or just by fluke, but Pacino plays this role really well because he just seems very uncomfortable as well.
Yeah, I was going to say, when he does ask him, you know, if his man smoked his pole or whatever it was.
Yeah, I think he says that as well. He says a few variations on has a man ever sucked your cock. I think he says smoked your pole. I think he says something else. It's great.
It is. It's like you just don't see it. It's bang. It sort of leads with it to Steve Burns. But Pacino's reaction to it, like he's not disgusted and he's not angry. He's more surprised.
Intrigued.
And yeah, it's really interesting, his reaction when that happens.
And throughout the film, so Pacino shows a tentativeness throughout the film and a bit of a reluctance to fully dive in to the S&M scene, but he's so intrigued by it. And, you know, there are times when he goes home to his girlfriend and he's just been at a hardcore S&M club watching dudes do all sorts of things to each other and then goes home and has sex with his wife straight away and really passionate sex. And so that obviously is telling us that this dude's probably a little bit turned on by what he's being surrounded by. And he has that moment too later in the film when he's talking to the captain about, he goes, I just don't know what this undercover gig's doing to me. It's changing me. Something's going on. It has this like little mini breakdown.
It's really clever how they portray him right through this movie because they never really conclusively say which way he's going, one way or the other, like you just explained, like the whole way from that moment that he's called in to see Captain Edelman till the very last scene, which we'll touch on later, very famous scene, they really never give anything away. But then there's a lot of clues, and like you said, like with his girlfriend Nancy, you know, there's these changes in the way that when they see each other at different periods of time through the film, like you said, the first time, very passionate, it's like rough sex. And I know Friedkin always, you know, talks about male sex being rough sex. So, you know, that's that first sort of hint of it. And the second time I think that they have sex, she goes down on him and you can hear the gay bars playing as it's happening because that's what he's hearing in his head. Like, incredible.
Yeah, it's a really interesting role for Pacino, and I've got to give him some credit for taking it on at all, because he is coming off the back of The Godfather, Godfather 1 and Godfather 2. So that entire like series has just cemented him as an instant legend in acting circles. Dog Day Afternoon was in the 70s and countless other incredible roles and iconic roles. And for him to take a role like this is in 1980, was this a massive leap of faith? Obviously, probably loved the script and loved Friedkin because Friedkin obviously had such a resume by then himself. Famously, though, Friedkin wasn't a massive fan of Pacino after this.
Mm. He said he was very unprepared, most unprepared actor he'd ever worked with.
Which is surprising to me. Whether or not that's just the way L kind of rolls, I'm not sure. I know that Michael Mann said something similar when working with Al Pacino with The Insider and with Heat. Not so much the unprepared thing, it's just the fact that I think, I won't say method acting, because I mean, Robert De Niro was the poster child for that with a few of his roles, but I think L wants to know the crux of what he's getting at, who he is as a character, as a person. And then just kind of runs with that. There's obviously a script in play. There's a screenplay that he has to stick to. And there's a story that he has to kind of work within. But he does like to put his own twist on things. So maybe that's where that disconnect came, because I'd find it really surprising to say that Pacino would be unprepared or disorganized when it came to researching or performing a role. But obviously the thing with William Friedkin is that dude, again, wasn't afraid to create something controversial, but also didn't give a fuck if he ruffled feathers and upset people with his blunt honesty. If he didn't like you, you would know. And if you did something that he didn't appreciate or agree with, you would know. So obviously him and Al might have had a few heated discussions and a few disagreements on set. Billy Friedkin could hold a grudge. He was one of nature's great haters.
Richard Gere was actually signed to do the role in Cruising, and it got reversed because Al Pacino saw the script and he basically said, no, I want to do it. They ousted Gere and brought in Pacino because Pacino was the flavor of the day. You know, watching the film myself, like, you could see Richard Gere playing this role very well.
I think so. Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, Richard Gere in the same year went on to star in American Gigolo, which was directed by Paul Schrader. Itself was kind of like a slight American twist on a giallo as well. American Gigolo just missed out on my top 10, by the way. I could definitely see Richard Gere in this role as well. I think, and this is going to sound really weird, I don't know how to say this without offending Richard Gere. Richard, if you're listening, I'm really sorry. I think Richard Gere would be more believable as a gay man, but I also don't think that he would be able to pull off that tortured, ambiguous type of feeling that Pacino gives through this in regards to, am I uncovering a side of myself that I don't know about? And like you said before, it toes the line of, is Pacino really enjoying this or is he disgusted by it? And I think, I'm not sure if Gere would pull that off as well as Pacino does in this.
Well, I think it should be noted as well. Friedkin does come around many years later and realizes that Pacino's character does work well as, you know, with him as the actor. He actually says, I didn't really understand it at the time, but I watch it now and I can see it work so well. And he said Pacino had never, ever been in this sort of world, the S&M world, and he said if there's fear on his face at different times, it's real. He's fucking scared. And
yeah, well, the thing is too, that's what the audience, if you're a straight heterosexual person that has never experienced this, like when I first saw this, and I saw this a long time ago now, the first time, I was like, holy shit, I wasn't disgusted, but I was stunned by some of the depictions. I know that it's been exaggerated somewhat, but a lot of this stuff still did really happen. There were some crazy bars, and I like the twist on it that a lot of these kind of S&M bars were like a gay version of CBGBs, like the punk rock kind of bars that just so happened to have a lot of guys sucking dick in the background instead of punk rock bands playing live. It was a really, again, uncomfortable, but just stunning thing to witness. And with Pacino having that kind of reaction as well, it's like a lot of the audience watching as well.
I was going to I had that same expression watching it.
Yeah, absolutely. We have the first on-screen murder, and then basically we travel through Pacino's kind of diving into the S&M community. I'll touch on soon the fact that we don't really know, or you can, and it's by design by Friedkin, that was there one killer? Are there two killers? Are there several killers? And there is a bit of trickery with that that's going on through the film. One scene I want to touch on first, though, because it's kind of like chronological, and I don't want to turn this podcast into a point A to point B about the plot, but I don't want to pass up the opportunity to talk about one of the great cameos in this film by Powers Booth. He is manning a shop in the S&M precinct, and they sell various toys and other kind of paraphernalia. Pacino walks in and sees all these different colored flags or hankies, and Al Pacino or Steve says to Powers Booth, hey, man, I see these hankies getting around. What's the go? I'm a bit new to the scene. what do the colors mean? And Powers Booth just deadpan goes, well, you got your blue flag there, and that's for a blowjob. If you got in your left pocket, that means you receive. If you got one in your right, that means you're giving a blowjob. The green hanky is if you're a hustler. If you're a hustler, it's on the left side. On the right, you're a buyer. So that's more a prostitution type of color. Yellow, on the left, you give golden showers, and on the right side, if you wear on the right side, that means you receive golden showers. And look, that's a pretty obvious color choice. Let's be honest.
Yeah,
right.
Makes sense.
That's that. To me, that's the one that's like, of course, if I like being peed on, I like peeing on someone else. Yellow is the obvious choice. So well done there. I'm sure our listeners would agree. Feel free to give us that feedback once I get the email up and going. Now, the red flag. What I love about this one is it's the last one and it's about to be explained. But after Powers Booth explains the golden shower thing, Pacino's like, oh, fuck this, man. Yeah, thanks, dude. I'm out. And just like leaves. Unfortunately, before he finds out about the red flag, because the red flag is the most graphic, and it is of course, now, Holsh, I've hogged the last three colours. It's your duty now to tell the viewers, or the listeners, I should say, about the red flag.
A scene not long after this where Al Pacino, or Steve Burns, is frequenting the bar again, and there's a gentleman that I'm almost assuming he had a red hanky in his back pocket when he entered the bar earlier that night. He is being hung up by four chains, and there's another gentleman that has his fist and up to sort of almost to his elbow lubricating up.
Mm, a lot of arm hair in that as well. So we've got a lot of KY jelly. And we have a lot of dark arm hair being kind of squished back from the lubricant.
Yes. And it gets really hectic in this scene, and it keeps spinning across to extracurricular activities that are happening around the bar as Steve is taking it all in. And then it sort of flicks over to this gentleman on the chains moaning really loudly, and it's funny because Friedkin is so proud of this. If you watch the commentary, it'll flick to it and Friedkin will be like talking about saying that's a fist fucking scene just there.
Is he really proud of it?
Yeah, and then he'll go and he'll be talking about something again, and it comes back to him. He's gone, yeah, that's that fist fucking scene. He's gone, we filmed that for ages, like 4 minutes. It was just fist fucking, and we had to take some out. And it's just
were they actually gay performers that were performing a real fist fucking?
Real, it was really happening. He states it. It's like literally really happening.
Wow,
it's funny because he also mentions that they had to take 40 minutes out of this film. And basically that 40 minutes, he said they just shot straight
gay porn.
And the reason he did that was he knew if he just gave the censorship, you know, what he wanted as the final product, he would have had to have cut it back. But what he did was he added in all this gay porn, and they went through 51 revisions where they were like, nah, you got to take that out. And they'd take out another bit and send it through. And it cost them $1,000 every time, which at the time was horrendous. Like, that's a lot of money at the time. So 51 grand, it cost them in iteration reviews, I guess. And eventually they took out 40 minutes of gay porn and they let them release the film.
That's a genius thing to do. Like, put in some really hectic stuff and it's like distracting them from the stuff he actually had intended to put out in the first place. That's just a masterstroke.
It is. It's really
clever. Masterstroke. Play on words. Unintentional, but yes, absolutely
masterstroke. Yeah, he was very proud of the fist fucking.
That's fantastic. I'm so happy that he was proud of it. And look, that entire scene is again, a lot to watch and a lot to take in. And literally, for that gentleman with the red hanky on his right side, there was a lot to take in. But another joke. The part that really gets to me is just those sweaty, leering looks that all the patrons are giving each other. It's just like everyone is just a piece of meat on display, ready to be taken. And correct me if I'm wrong, but is that the same scene where we see Pacino with his first colored flag and he's got the golden shower flag in?
Yeah, I don't know if that was the one. It might be. It might be. But, yeah, I think
there was a few scenes that I sometimes confuse, and I think maybe it's not. Maybe it's a scene beforehand. But the first scene that Pacino wears that golden shower flag, he has another yellow flag, and he's displaying it around his neck in quite artistic fashion. And he goes up and goes, "Hey, man, I see your flag there." And Al Pacino's like, "Oh, yeah, nah, I just like to watch." And he just goes, "You're a fucking poser. Get out of here." I love that.
I love his quote, though. When he goes up to him, he's like, "I see you're into water sports."
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, it's so good. But I think you're right. I think that is a scene prior in a different club. I might not be remembering correctly. And look, I've got the memory of a goldfish. I only just rewatched this 2 days ago. But that's the fisting scene. Is that in the club when they are having like this police night where they're all dressed up as police officers?
I don't think it's that one either. I think it's there's three of them. And I think it's just one of the first ones when he's understanding what is in the S&M clubs. It's sort of just him spinning out going, "Holy shit, this is..."
What a fucking deep end to dive into. Yeah. So you're like, "Oh, yeah, I'll go undercover. Yeah, this sounds... Yeah, it sounds exciting."
But that turns scene-
up, some dude's getting fisted. Fuck me.
That scene, though, that you mentioned him wearing the golden bandana, that you said about all the leering, etc., I think that is such a key scene where it's you're seeing it through his eyes, and as each different character walks past and basically stops and looks at him from less than a meter away and moves on. That's where it really starts to talk about, you know, this identity theme in this movie. And in those characters that walk past him, one of them is Joe Spinell, who is the police officer at the beginning in the car with the trans women. So, you know, there's a police officer and you don't know it, especially the first time you watch it, but you also see a killer look at him at that scene as well. Whether it's, like we said, no one knows if that's one of the killers, many killers, the killer. But this theme of identity and not knowing who's around you, who you're with, is really prominent in this scene.
And not even knowing yourself. Right, yes. And which is, again, you get a sense towards the end that Al Pacino has lost a sense of self somewhat.
Mm.
He's like, "Who the fuck am I? If I've been finding this titillating, I'm not who I thought I was." So it is a film that is largely a discussion on identity. And look, there are many different ways you can take this film and many different theories, and there are thousands of them out there on the internet. I think the Spinell character, the cop, who you see, and it's not just in the bar. I think you see him a few other times through the film, and he's the first cop on scene for one of the deaths right at the end of the film as well. If you wanted to wrap the film up neatly and think, okay, there is a killer, I think probably the most logical person to pin it on, in my opinion, would be him.
The cop.
I think the cop.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I've always thought that with his aggression at the start, and with his absolute nihilistic and misogynistic worldview in the cop car, and the way he was the one that jumps out of the cop car and apprehends the two trans women, I just think that he could be responsible for some, if not all, the deaths or murders, I should say.
Yeah, he walks past, when we talked about that stone archway or the overpass scene where he walks past and stops and looks back and stares at Pacino there as well.
Absolutely. So he shows up multiple times. So I think if you wanted to pin it on one person, if this is how you want to wrap up the film for yourself, personally, that's how I do. I think it's purposely, and it is. I mean, it's been noted as it's been a purposely ambiguous type of note by Friedkin that there isn't really one killer to blame on this. It is a story and it is basically a narrative about identity. And it seems like the killer himself is played by different actors in each of the scenes. Like they change look. They're all similar in look, but some have got acne scarring, some have got different teeth, some are wearing sunglasses, some have got different eyes, some are taller, shorter, voice changes. There are differences in each one. And I think that's what the intent is by Friedkin. I think he wants to confuse us. I think he doesn't want us to easily pin who the killer is. He wants that confusion. He wants to muddy the waters because they were confusing times. It was a crazy scene.
To put it in context for the listeners as well, in one of the scenes where we might have the killer and a victim, that next scene, that killer becomes the victim and so forth. I'm not going to go into the details, but like you said, it mix and matches the whole way around.
Even to the point where one of the, I think it might be the second murder, the murderer is dressed in a certain way and the person that he murders appears to be the killer from the first murder.
Yes.
And then the killer in the second murder in the park is dressed in a certain way. And then then the next scene is Pacino getting home to his apartment dressed identically to how the killer was just before.
Yeah. Mindfucks all over the place. And the other thing I was going to say is the greatest mindfuck of all is that they're all dubbed by another voice. This other gentleman, James Sartorius, voices all of the killers, but is not in the movie at all.
Oh, wow. I never knew that. I had an idea that it was dubbed. It did seem a bit detached at times. And I thought that was obviously an artistic choice to unnerve the viewer, but I didn't realize they were all the same voice.
Yeah. Well, there's even a gentleman at the end, closer to the end, a father figure that you would know the scene of, and his voice is also dubbed by this actor that is not in the film. No, I think Friedkin's trying to say, like, yeah, look, it's the same voice of the killer, but this is just to generalize what's happening in this area, because he changes the identities, but it's still the one voice, almost like, look, it's just never going to stop because...
Like it's a transference of some sort. It's almost like a need to kill gets transferred from one character to the other. And there's also been quite a few theories out there that Pacino was the killer, especially towards the end. It alludes to something like that.
I think it's very possible. Like it still crosses my mind that I think he could be, but I'm
especially
not sure.
Especially those last couple, maybe?
It's certainly something I haven't ruled out.
Now, one of the scenes that is really creepy but so artfully done is there is a peep show scene where we follow a gentleman that finishes his day at work, goes home, quickly gets changed, heads out, goes cruising, and goes to another gay club where there is a peep show attached. He makes eyes with another patron and they enter the peep show together. And there's people all around. There's people outside the peep show. And so that this is a very public place. So this is even more so public than a murder that takes place in the park, because at least they are kind of obscured by, they walk away from people and they're obscured by view. What happens in this scene is there are still people outside the door of the peep show. They basically go into this room, put some money in, the window goes up and it's showing a pornographic film. And basically it instantly cuts to this grisly knife attack. And there is such an awesome shot in this, and I'm sure you picked up on it too, Hulsh, is when the silhouette or the shadow has the pornography playing in the background and you see the arm up with the knife. And that's such a, you know, giallo touch. And it is, again, vibrant blues on the screen. So they're watching a blue movie with this really vibrant blue in the background. And then also cuts to red in the hallway, which obviously signifies death. And that's a common color choice, obviously. And we've spoken about it with Inferno, and you know, you can go back to a lot of the classic horror films and especially giallos, that's when there is a death occurring or about to occur, there'll be vibrant reds. But the use of the blue and red in that scene is incredible.
Also with that scene, I think it's the most incredibly shot scene in this whole film. It's one of those scenes where it's really pronounced that you also notice some subliminal cuts away. Friedkin often uses subliminal screenshots from time to time. He used them in The Exorcist as well. And in this, it's like only one or two frames and it's anal penetration. So he's put them in before a number of the murders, and he said, I felt that because the murderer used a knife, a very sharp-edged knife, to kill his victims, that there was a kind of reference to anal intercourse. So he has these little shots that just bang up on the screen and then disappear, and it's anal intercourse, and that is really pronounced in this particular scene in the peep show. But it's also funny because in the peep show, there's another subliminal shot that goes back and it shows the gentleman that got murdered in the first murder. Freakin's always messing with you.
He's fucking with identity the whole way through. For a movie that's fairly straightforward as far as concept and as far as, like, we've got a potential serial killer in a certain community, that throwing in of the ambiguity when it comes to identity just creates this massive curveball for this film.
That curveball is even bigger in the scene because the gentleman that walked, you know how you said he eyes off one guy and that guy follows him in? That's not the guy acting in there that murders him. So we have one actor walk into the peep show as the killer, and then the person in the peep show as the killer is a different actor again.
I fucking thought so. I thought so. And, like, I knew, because you watch this enough, you're like, oh, well, that's a different actor, that's a different person. Again, there are subtle differences with these dudes. A lot of them are very similar in look, but again, like I said before, there are certain little differences, like teeth or acne scarring or, you know, eyes, but they're very similar but slightly different and noticeable enough. And I don't think I was paying enough attention, but yeah, I don't doubt it at all. That's obviously what he's doing again. Freakins is fucking with us. That's incredible. Now, going back to that scene, one thing that makes me laugh like crazy is, well, two parts of this film, and that sounds really weird talking about laughing during cruising, but one scene I love that makes me laugh out loud is when he does turn up to the club and they're having a dress-up night, a police-themed night where everyone in there is dressed up as a cop.
Precinct night.
Precinct night. That was it. Precinct night. And there are a lot of handcuffs getting around, as you can imagine. He walks in and gets instantly fingered, no pun intended, all pun intended, as a cop, like a real-life cop. The bartender comes over and goes,
"Where you going, friend?
What do you mean?
Got a knife, gun, anything at all?
Why? What's wrong?
You a police officer.
Why?
This is precinct night. You've got the wrong attitude. I'm afraid I'm going to have to ask you to leave."
Al Pacino's like trying to be, "No, man, I'm just here, you know. I'm just a gay man just trying to hang out." And he's like, "No, you're not. You're a fucking police officer. Can you leave?" I love that part.
It also refers back to the scene that you mentioned earlier where the trans woman's trying to get Captain Edelman to get those coppers off their back. And he says to them, "Look, there's more people out there dressed as cops than cops themselves." You know, and,
that's,
and,
right. Well, that's true. That's a really good pickup.
Yeah. And then this comes out. I'm like, holy shit. Now this makes sense. You know, what
he's
saying.
That's a great pickup. Like, he was using it to refer to the fact there are people out there dressed as cops and committing crimes, faking being a cop, but it actually relates to that as well, to the scene having, and look, there's a lot of iconography in the scene. There's like some real kind of almost Nazi-esque iconography with those big eagles, you know, that very kind of almost fascist type of iconography used through the leather, the heavy leather scene. And again, that goes hand in hand with the police force as well. You know, there are people out there that call the police a fascist network, and you know, in some parts they are. So that kind of goes hand in hand with that as well. The other thing I love too, Holmes, is when he finally, when I say he, Pacino obviously, lets his guard down and goes to a club, and it's the first time he goes and he starts huffing some drugs and he starts dancing. And the fucking dancing that he does is so obviously straight and so obviously cop. It's not even fucking, oh, it's great. It just fills me with so much joy. Every time I see this, like it's really aggressively jagged kind of moves. There's no rhythm to it at all. He's at least bisexual, but mostly straight in the way he dances. It's fucking great. I love that scene.
Yeah, every single time.
So like we were saying, identity is a major theme in this film. And what's your take on it, Holmes? And I don't think there is, like we both said before, I don't think Friedkin meant for this to be a film where you can pinpoint a certain killer. I think if you need to, you can. You could probably make a case for about two or three characters in this film as being a singular killer. But are you of the idea or theory that it's a single or multiple killer?
Okay, if I was going to make a gut call, I think it's multiple killers. But to be fair, I had never even really considered Joe Spinell, the cop, being one of the killers. I thought that it was Pacino is the killer at the end. And there's a couple of reasons I thought that. And it's a really small detail, but earlier in the film when Pacino is caressing, this is before he is even started the job, and he's with his girlfriend Nancy, and she mentions his father, and he sort of has a really awkward silence about it, and she was like, you know, don't worry about it, and they just leave it. That's all it is. But then later on, the final pinned killer, as such, that as far as the movie is concerned, has father concerns as well, and is trying to, the way it's portrayed is he's trying to correct, or he, you know, he's a self-hating gay himself. You know, he's a gay man, but he also is, because of his father, he is embarrassed by it. So he is basically doing the work of his father to kill other gay men. You have that scene that he talks to his dad, even though his dad's not there because his dad was dead 10 years ago in the park. So because there's this like familiarity with that character, and there's these little connections with Pacino in a similar fashion, I kind of felt like, you know, okay, this guy did murder, but you know what? I think Pacino's in the exact same
mindset.
That's the way I thought when it finished. I was like, nah, I think there's other people with this same sort of mindset in this community as well, that which is why there's multiple killers. But
like a self-hatred just making them do. I had the same kind of theory when I thought Spinell was the or one of the killers. That self-hatred, you could see in that opening scene that he just hates humanity. He hates women. He hates gay people. He hates trans people. It feels like he's acting out those fantasies, both in a sexual manner, but then in a violent manner as well. But what you just said about Pacino, I picked up on the awkwardness about the question about his father or the conversation about his father, but I never really applied that to that last murder. That's a great pickup.
A couple of days ago when I watched the commentary, Friedkin just says, even there, he was gone. I don't know if many people know this, but he has a moment there when he thinks about his father. And that's all he says as well. But he does mention it. And I'm like,
that could be a little bit of a bit of an Easter egg.
I honestly think it is. And
he's dropping the hints, Billy Friedkin.
Billy's a hint man. He says in the commentary as well, this is a movie I did not want to hold your hand at all. So, and he obviously doesn't.
This is why I fucking love it. This is why I love most films that I love. I never feel unsettled if I don't fully understand the film. In fact, I sometimes really enjoy the fact where I come out of something that is so engrossing and at times confusing, but I don't need it wrapped up into a nice little package for me. Sometimes, though, I do like to deep dive, and that's what I love about you too, Holsch, is that you will find these threads and then make sense of them. So it opens up a whole new thing for me when I watch these films as well. But that I never really applied that scene about Pacino's father. So basically we're getting towards the end of the film. Let's talk about the second or third last scene, which is the hips and lips showdown. A really great line read in this is basically Al Pacino's targeted this dude who he suspects to be the murderer, cruises up to him, they meet in the park, they go somewhere to basically fuck. And as they're getting undressed, they're being quite aggressive to each other. It appears that the mark that Pacino has knows that he is onto him as well, whether he is law enforcement or in some way connected to someone that is either stalking him or looking at him. So there's this kind of weird confrontation as they're about to undress, and he asks Pacino, how big are you? and Pacino says, party size. And fuck yeah, Al, me too, bro, me too.
How big are you?
Party size.
What are you into?
I go anywhere.
I don't do anything.
That's cool. Hips or lips.
So when you say party size, that could go one of two ways.
Well, it depends if you like to have a really big, messy party. If you're after a big, 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 messy party, then no, I'm not party size. If you just like to have a really nice, relaxing time with some fun and comfort, I am party size.
I always think party size is when you get the big packets of lollies and they're like the really tiny, the party size pack.
Yeah, exactly.
Is that what you're thinking as well?
I don't know. So, yeah, you can get your party size pack, like Cheetos. I bought my son. I don't want to mention my son in the gist of this entire scene, but I bought my son a party pack of Cheetos, and it was bigger than a normal size.
Ah, yeah, okay.
So it could be that, but I do love that. How big are you? I'm just party size. And I'm probably going to try that on with my wife later on.
I was thinking a party size Mars bar is a lot smaller than a normal Mars bar.
Oh, yeah. See, there is that. Yeah, there's that rationale too, because you put them in those party packs so you can fit more of the lollies in.
But I understand what you're saying. Party size packet. Okay.
Yeah,
anyway.
enough about myself and Al Pacino being party size. Great scene. And it's one that where basically Pacino gets the jump on him. He's, look, suspecting that Al Pacino isn't who he says he is. He's a bit of a fraud. He's obviously, and I think, you know, obviously he suspects that Pacino, rightly, is law enforcement. Basically goes to swing a punch, and before he can do that, Pacino stabs him, which then leads us to a scene in the hospital where you've got the captain, Paul Sorvino, just absolutely hammering this dude to confess to all of the murders. He wants him to cop to everything. And dude's just absolutely reluctant and seemingly sincere. He's like, I didn't fucking do this.
While we were on this scene where Savino is trying to extract a confession from this guy for all of the murders, I have to explain the reason Friedkin puts this into the movie in the first place. This is the craziest story to come out of cruising from my research. It blows my mind, and I know I've spoken to you about it, and it blows your mind. We mentioned earlier that Friedkin is big, big on the research side of things, and it just so happened that during these late 70s, there was this number of cruising murders in real life, and he was trying to base all of these murders in here as close as possible to what actually happened, that they were using the exact same hotel rooms, little details to that. Anyway, in 1973 in The Exorcist, there was an extra in this film, and he even has a speaking role. He's like a radiologist. Is it Linda Blair?
Linda Blair's the actress.
Yeah, so Linda Blair is getting some crazy thing shoved in her neck with blood coming out, really hard scene, and he's holding her head and sort of conducting this surgery on her. This gentleman gets pinned in the late 70s for one of these cruising murders. Now, Friedkin gets his lawyer to speak to the authorities and he gets permission to go and talk to this bloke. Now, this guy admits that he did remember doing one of these murders, and the cops...
One of them, so he was actually suspected of more than one.
This is where it comes. The cops said to him, if you confess to all of the murders, I think it was like six, if you confess to all of the murders, instead of life, we'll give you 20 years, just so that they could write them off the books. And that is why in the movie, at this scene that you're talking about right now, Captain Edelman says to the bloke, we need you to give us a confession for all the murders because of what happened in real life. The cops in that instance as well were just trying to get them all written off. So even though there's probably three or four killers involved potentially in this movie, Captain Edelman's trying to get them all written off by getting one fall guy just to admit to all of them for a reduced sentence.
That just shows the utter fucking contempt that the police had for the gay community. They didn't want to spend any more time on this because of the disgust it brought them. As we said before with that scene at the autopsy where it wasn't the dead body, it wasn't the act of murder that was making him feel sick. It was the homosexual acts that he was hearing about that was making him feel sick. They didn't want to do any extra police work on this because it was the gay community. They just wanted this fucking done, gone, and let's pin it on one dude. That is incredible.
Yeah. It blows my mind that, you know, that he is based all of this around real actions in the real world, and one of them actually starred in his biggest film.
Yeah, wow, that's incredible. Yeah, when you were telling me parts of that story, I forgot that he actually had to cop to all of the murders. I remember you saying that one of the bit players in The Exorcist actually was a part of the scene and was convicted of a murder. That just blows my mind. Well, it really does.
He ends up accepting that too. He confessed all the murders so that he didn't get life.
And did he get released after 20 years?
He must have. He must have.
Wow. Okay, that's incredible. Yeah, that's, again, Billy freaking on his freaking shit. That is crazy. That is crazy.
So one other well-known scene, and probably one of the most talked-about scenes, also catches everybody by surprise, and it's obviously not as uncomfortably notorious as the fisting scene, but it is the scene. There's an interrogation. Pacino's hauled into the police station with, what was the other character's name there, Holsch? The one that they had, pardon the pun, fingered as the potential serial killer. They had them both in the police station being interrogated by the police. And then all of a sudden they bring in a bit of backup. And by a bit of backup, I mean they bring in what appears to be a 7-foot black man wearing nothing but a cowboy hat, biker boots, and a jock strap. Mm-hmm. And he unleashes just pure violence on both Pacino and the suspect, just slaps and backhands the absolute shit out of them. Even Pacino. So Pacino's still keeping up this act as a gay man hustler in the underground S&M scene. He hasn't basically let on that he's the undercover cop in this. But it's a great scene, Holsch.
Oh, mate. The way he pulls his hand back before he slaps him is like he's about to try and hit a one-wood in a golf shot. He absolutely lays into them. But, yeah, that's another one of these amazing facts that Friedkin has went and discovered. A couple of the guys in the film are actual cops that are some of the main actors in the police force, ones that aren't seen in such a terrible manner. And one of them explained to Friedkin that this is something that they actually did over there in the police force. They'd bring out this 7-foot black man in a jockstrap and a cowboy hat and basically let him lay into him because down the track...
So to beat confessions out of them?
Yeah, to beat confessions out of them because the absurdity of it when it came to the judge talking to this guy that... maybe saying that he's been assaulted by the police, in this case assaulted by this character in a cowboy hat and a jockstrap, and the judge just goes, yeah, buddy, sounds good.
Yeah, sure, that happened. So they use it in that way to kind of discredit the suspect.
Yeah, apparently it was legit. That's what they used to do all the time, just so they could still try and get the confession, but at the same time cover their ass because it just sounded so nonsensical, so unbelievable.
It's ludicrous. And that is such a funny type of factoid that, of course, William Friedkin would use that. That is such a Billy Friedkin thing to latch on to and use.
Unbelievable. And one last little piece, just on, while we're on the back of this Friedkin research, is that nursery rhyme that's used in practically every single murder where, you know,
who's here? I'm here. You're here.
That is so creepy.
It's creepy as fuck. And well, he also, this is an actual fact, and that exact nursery rhyme or tune or whatever we call it was actually used in the murders because he spoke to one of the murder survivors. So a person in the S&M community that was attacked, but in the end didn't die. And he said that the killer used that particular rhyme. So Friedkin slotted it into the movie. And it's hard to picture this movie without that rhyme in my eyes.
Yeah, that is so menacing. It's just, oh man. Yeah. Just bone chilling.
Yeah, especially when they're in Central Park and you hear it and it's like you don't know where it's coming from.
And that's the thing. It's so disorientating in that scene. Like, you just don't know where, what direction it's coming from, where the killer is coming from. You know the killer's basically en route, is about to do his thing, but it's just a really off-putting use. And the fact that it's some real-life shit is just, again, just fucking terrifying.
It is, it is. So anyway, that's a couple of little more tidbits. There's so many with Friedkin, but I thought there were a couple more of the interesting ones.
Yeah, for sure. We basically reached the end of the film, except for there is one last murder that we see. And again, this is where I kind of, my end theory is that there are two murderers and I think they're both cops. I think Spinell is responsible for most of them. And I think I'm on the same kind of train of thought as you as far as Pacino. I didn't pick up on the father link as much as you did, but just the link between the last victim and Pacino kind of sold it to me, and the response and the reaction by the captain at that last murder scene, the horrific look and the look of him kind of putting two and two together that this could be the result or the work of one of his undercover detectives. And then that flashing scene right at the end where it takes us back to Steve Burns's or Pacino's apartment with his partner, the kind of washing of hands and the, right, I'm out, I'm a new person, I'm back to the old me. That suggests to me that there was almost an exorcism of sorts through violence. He saw too much. He saw too much of himself. He thought of himself in a different way, didn't like it, didn't like what it was making him think, feel, that connection to his father that you brought up. So my last theory on that last victim, my final theory is that that is a Pacino murder.
Nancy then putting on the actual leather suit that the killer wore throughout the entire movie, that's got to be the kicker.
I think so as well, absolutely. What's your thoughts? I know you said before that you're under the impression it was multiple killers and that Pacino was one of them. Yeah. You stand by that?
I stand by that. That's just the way I've perceived it. I feel like it makes sense in my mind at least.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it does too. As much sense as it's going to make. Yeah. And again, a Friedkin has purposely mind-fucked us through the entire thing. Right. And it's such a really clever way of doing it as well. Like I said, straightforward type of plot. It's basically just a murder mystery serial killer through a small niche kind of scene, albeit a pretty controversial type of S&M sex, gay sex scene. But the way that, you know, he plays with identity and shifts focus and changes actors, that is just so unique, and just I loved it. I think it's a fantastic choice, an artistic choice. I love this movie. And again, I would encourage anybody that hasn't seen this and is an Al Pacino fan to definitely search this out if you haven't seen it. It is, like we said, a very uncomfortable watch at times, and it's one to watch definitely away from anyone too young. You'll be getting asked some pretty awkward questions if you watch this in front of certain people, that's for sure. My wife walked in on me watching scenes of this and said, "What the fuck are you watching?" And the more I tried to explain, I'm like, oh, you know, it's just, you know, it's a movie about some gay sex subculture S&M, and there's a lot of guys getting murdered and there's a bit of fisting, and I was just like digging the hole deeper every time I tried to explain what the fuck I was watching.
It's hard following up from bad timing as well, where it's a very different movie but very similar reactions.
Oh, yeah, for sure. You're not going to be watching this with your significant other at bedtime. Let's just say that. Maybe you are. That's cool. And that's cool too. Let your freak flag fly. You do you and do anybody you want to do as long as it's consensual. Isn't that right, Holsch?
That's right. Get your red hanky ready.
That's it. Only on your red side. Yeah, that's the fist side. Shouts out to Snoop Dogg and Drop It Like It's Hot. I think that's us. I think that's us done for episode 4.
Yeah, that was absolute so much fun.
It's a great movie, man. And look,
we've had back-to-back sexual kind of heavy, heavy sexual type of obsession and sexual violence films. We will be taking a break from that. I hear a collective sigh from the audience.
And Holfi. Collective
yeah,
sigh.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm sorry to have subjected you to this for the last 2 weeks. We do have a big, pretty big heavy hitter for the next episode. Feedback from a few friends is that they've really enjoyed a few of the films that they've watched, but they hadn't heard of a few of these. And again, some of my friends in certain film circles, these will be films that they know about and they've seen and they've enjoyed. But I've got a lot of friends that are, again, discovering a few of these films for the first time. But the next film, I believe, will be one of the more well-known selections for 1980. It stars another goat. And like I said at the start of the episode, I'm collecting goats. I'm a goat enthusiast. Mm-hmm. There is one hell of a goat in this next film. And that's all I'm going to say. I'm just going to sprinkle out a little hint.
That's a fair hint. If people look at 1980, there's a couple that definitely...
There's a lot of goats. There's a lot of goats doing work in 1980.
Yeah, there's going to be a lot of bleating yet.
Yeah, you better believe it. Excellent. Well, thank you very much, Laura listeners, for joining us again for episode 4 of Lifetime Cinema Club. Like I plugged earlier, we have an Instagram now. We have a presence on Reddit. Come along, tell us what we're doing right, what we're doing wrong. Give us some feedback, positive, negative, whatever. Feedback is feedback. Get on, let us know what you're thinking. There will be a Twitter presence soon. Fuck calling it X. There'll be a Twitter presence soon. There will be a email address for you to send off questions. And if you send off and we receive an interesting question, something that we can run, we'll run it in the episode. At the end of each episode, we'll answer your questions, hard-hitting questions. You just send them through to us. We'll do it. For episode 4, I think that's us done. Thank you very much, Holfi.
Thanks, mate.
Love your work. Thank you so much for all the research. You're my research absolute guru. For those of you out there, please get into cruising. But just be cautious on which side you wear the red flag. Peace.